the work we're doing in Calgary. Most of you know me as a theorist, but I'm going to be speaking about experimental issues. And actually, what I'm going to talk about, I think, nicely complements Norbert's talk just before. Norbert was looking at some real-world issues, but a lot of the systems and devices inside, you know, he was referring to their performance. But so one of the things that we're looking at is we're trying to actually get these systems and devices inside to be able to perform better. And so I'm going to take us through, in this talk, I'll take us through some of the key experimental issues, but I'm doing it as a theorist, so we won't get too bogged down in a lot of the experimental complications. Also, if you have any questions along the way, feel free to interrupt. I kind of like the back and forth thing. Okay, let me just figure out. Oh, it doesn't appear. Okay, I'll gesture. So what I'm going to present here is largely a result of a conversation that Wolfgang Tittle and I had. Wolfgang Tittle has joined the University of Calgary. He's an industrial research chair. He's sponsored by General Dynamics Canada. The goal is to build these real-world devices. The reason that I use the term real-world here is because our goal is to make it all work, not in a lab, but in existing networks. We want to buy things off the shelf, use equipment that we get from others, and put it through the existing optical fiber networks we have in Calgary. We're working with the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology, so we've got lab. Oh, this is one. Oh, that one works?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I'm going to use this. It's better. Okay, I'll gesture with this. So we have a lab at the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology, and that's got 7 kilometers of fiber. We're setting up that renting dark fiber from Bell, and so that's our goal. And then there's various agencies that fund this. Okay. So what we've done is to set a goal of getting 10 megabits a second or 10 megahertz of secret key generation. So this is what we want to achieve in about 4 years. And a lot of the security issues that Norbert mentioned come to play here. We're going to proceed along what are standard assumptions and hope that the theory also develops at the same time to determine how secure it is, how much, what assumptions go on behind it. But we don't want to not do the experiments while we work out a theory of security. They need to go together in tandem. So this is what we want, is 10 megabits per second of secret key generation rate with some reasonable definition some reasonable but strong definition what it is. And then the goal, of course, would be to use it for quantum key distribution. And although everybody would like to use it in a one-time pad setting, more likely to be an AES. And so if you use AES, we could get refresh rates of, say, 40 refreshes per millisecond or something. The reason we picked 10 megabits per second is because this is what commercial people tell us would spark their interest. And the current rate, you know, and again, subject to lots of question marks over security, is about 1,000 times less. I'm going to go into some of these things and explain it. They use a clock rate of 2 megahertz, and after you take into account all the inefficiencies along the way, and if you're only worried about sending 10 kilometers, so the further that you send, the more losses there are. So 10 kilometers can be thought of as a benchmark. So 10 kilometers using a pulse rate of 0.2, and of course that has to be kept small, as Norbert mentioned in his talk about the photon number splitting attack, that can bound how much you can send. So if you send typically 1/5 of a photon per pulse, send it over 10 kilometers, then you're only at 10 kilohertz of key generation. So trying to pick up the performance by a factor of 1,000 is not very easy. What you'd like to do is just to scale everything up, but the components just don't scale. So we need new inventions along the way. So there are various things that I'll point out that just won't scale, and you have to invent new things to be able to get the better performance. And the main barrier at the moment is the detector. So the detector is what keeps everything going so slowly. And I'll just explain a bit. Since the detector is the major obstacle to getting fast quantum key distribution, it's worth understanding why it has to be so slow. What is typically used at telecom wavelengths is an indium gallium arsenide avalanche photodetector. And the reason that it can't go much faster than the megahertz, 2 megahertz clock rate, is because there's a dead time. And I'll explain a bit about the dead time. But if we want to get 10 megabits per second and have other things still operate as they do now, then we would really need to pick up the clock to 10 gigahertz. So why is it so slow? Well, okay, so I'm doing this talk at the last minute. That's the one picture you're going to get. Everything's going to be words. No formulas, though, but just words. So that's a picture of an avalanche photo detector. And what happens is we have to use a detector that will work at telecom wavelengths and will work at weak fields. So sending one-fifth of a photon per pulse is extremely weak. You can't just plug in any detector into it. And so what you do is you put a bias on your detector with some voltage V, and then you look at the gain. And what you want is you want to put in some bias on the system, and then when you get a weak, weak field, you want that voltage to jump. So you're very tightly constrained on how you operate this, and then what you typically do is bias it. Now, it turns out that the gain of the detector is flat up to something known as a breakthrough voltage. When it hits the breakthrough voltage, then it will jump. So if this weak field hits the detector, you'll then get a giant voltage jump. So you want to operate the detector so that you're working right below that breakthrough voltage here, and then when the field comes, it jumps to infinity. So you have this highly nonlinear response to the incoming field. So that's what we want to do. Also, you want to make sure that you're working with a short time period, and that's because of the dark count rate. So what you do is you hit it with a bias that just takes it above the breakthrough voltage, so it's extremely sensitive, but for a short period of time. And so that's another reason these detectors are so good. If you only bias it for 2 nanoseconds, so 2 billionths of a second, then you get the sensitivity to pick up the photon, but you also you can also limit your dark count rates. And the dark count rates are very important in considering security issues. So you have to be able to design your detector. So dark counts are things like cosmic rays or remnant charge effects in a detector or something. Dark counts are essentially false counts you get. So if I send you no photon and your detector goes click, that's a dark count. So we want to be able to keep this short time scale. So the detector is beautiful in the sense that we can have high sensitivity to weak field at telecom wavelengths, and we can make sure that we cut the dark count. But the problem is that when you use these detectors, you have electrons that get trapped in impurities in the system, and these trapped electrons sit around for microseconds, and what you have to do is wait for these electrons to get untrapped and disappear before you can do the next trigger event. So you can see that this microsecond dead time, the time it takes for these trapped electrons to disappear, tells you you can't go above megahertz clock rates. So this detector is just no good if we're going to get up to, if we want to pick up orders of magnitude in our key generation rate. So the message here is the breakthrough, if we want to get the breakthroughs on key generation rate, we need new detector technology. That's where the that's where I think a priority needs to be. Yeah.
Could you use another pair of detector or another detector and switch?
Oh, so.
Or, I mean, like taking time for the first detector to relax, and then you use another one.
Yeah. Okay. So, in case you didn't hear, the question is, can you? It's not a stupid question, by the way. Can't you just use more detectors and then be able to switch? So you want to be able to, have your photons coming in and then you just multiplex it, I guess. So it just goes off to the detectors. I mean, in principle, it's possible, but then you'd have to have the fast switching, which is non-trivial. No, it's easier. It's probably easier to make better detectors because we have ideas on it. And having like 1,000 detectors, and having some switch that will direct to a different detector, because you've got these 2 nanosecond timescales. So how many times does 2 nanoseconds fit in a microsecond? So you would just be trying to multiplex. You'd try to be running electronics at nanosecond timescales. So I don't think it's feasible, but in principle, it's a good idea.
No, but one thing is, if you switch, you have to switch
again. That's true.
Sure,
yeah, every component you add would also add to loss. Okay. Or diffraction grating or something that does it probabilistically. I guess, but then how many detectors do you need? And then if you start diffracting or do it randomly, then, like, if you do it deterministically, at least you only need about 1,000. But if you do it randomly, then it seems like you need even orders of magnitude more. Is that right? Yeah. Or if you're using two.
No, if you get two signals in a row that are sent within a 2 hour time limit that are sent to the same sector, then you lose one of them, maybe they get confused with both of them. So long as it's not very common, it's not very
common. Okay.
Hmm?
Oh, I'm feedback loop. Okay. that's right. But I'll show you in a moment that we have to get down to 100 picosecond scale. So 100 picosecond scale. So then I think these get even harder. Okay, I'll keep going then. But these are good points. Okay. Then when the InGaAs avalanche photodiode still has other problems, we do hear about high efficiency detectors. But at telecom wavelengths, they're not very efficient. So our detectors have an efficiency of 10%. It's a quantum efficiency. The dark count rate, fortunately, is quite small, so the probability of getting a dark count in the 2 nanosecond window that the detector's open is 10 to the minus 5. However, you could improve the quantum efficiency by raising the bias voltage, and then you're in the sensitive region, much more sensitive region, but the problem is that even though you can boost your quantum efficiency, your dark count rate goes up much faster. So you have this trade-off, and the trade-off is not good. So given the formulas about what constitutes security in these systems, it seems to be better to run in the regime where you only have an efficiency of 10%. So that's also a problem at telecom wavelengths, which is what in Calgary we want to transmit at. And then there's the quantum bit error rate that is the determiner of security, and that's just the probability that you get a wrong result given a photon was sent and you get the wrong bit value, then that would be the quantum bit error rate, and that's a function of the dark count rate and the arrival probability, which of course depends on the loss in the system. So you have to calculate all these things. But the detector is absolutely critical. Notwithstanding the imaginative ideas that just came up, the effort is going on into making better detectors with new designs to be able to get around these problems. Okay, now Norbert talked quite a bit about the photon number splitting attack, so I won't go into much of it, just to remind you that it proceeds by having the eavesdropper peel off photons. So when you send this weak coherent pulse, it has, say, a Poisson distribution of number of photons. When the number of photons is greater than 1, then the eavesdropper could, in principle, go in, strip away photons, measure those, and learn something. And so the photon number splitting attack tells you that you have to limit the strength of the beam. You have to have weak beams. And the weak beams are always less than 1 photon per pulse. So why don't you send an average of 1 photon per pulse? Problem is then you have significant probability of 2 photons per pulse, and every one of those can be compromised. So this puts a bound on how many photons you can send. More recently, there's work, and Hoi Kwong's done a lot on this, on the decoy states. But even with the decoy states, you're still limited to less than 1 photon per pulse. So they're still very weak. And if you're in weak pulses, that puts an upper bound again on how many bits you can transmit. And so far you're pretty safe in thinking of less than a photon per pulse as some bound in calculating the rates. Significantly less, well, at least half that. And then this question, I don't actually know the answer. I mean, maybe it's done. But if you start combining this with quantum relay or quantum repeater technology, I don't really understand how to do it with decoy states yet. So if you want to be able to break distance barriers through those, it's something, it'd be worth talking about, because I don't know how that would work. Okay, and then, so that will again bound the rates that you can get, and then you have the photon number splitting attack will bound it. And then afterwards, there's all the post-processing that takes place, and the post-processing involves the error correction, privacy amplification, authentication, and currently this is done by software. And software is fast enough at kilohertz bit generation rates, but we don't think it's going to be fast enough if we want to get up to megabits per second. So at the megahertz rate, it might not be possible. So one of the things that we're doing in Calgary is we're working with the microelectronics group trying to design integrated chips, Graham Julian, to design the integrated chips so that we can go from software to hardware to try to speed up that processing. So that, we think that will be another one, a barrier that comes up as we speed up the system. Okay, so in order to get the rates up to megabits per second, and bearing in mind all the practical issues, then we probably need 10 gigahertz or so for pulse generation rate. So that means that Alice would have to generate photons to send to Bob at about 10 billion a second, so it's quite high. And then when you do the calculations, you discover that in order to do that, you only have 100 picoseconds between successive pulses. And in order for the pulses to be distinct, they can't be longer than 50 picosecond durations. So this, you know, in order to get to 10 megabits a second, these are the kinds of numbers you have to bear in mind for the length of pulses. And once you get to this level of 50 picosecond pulses and switching over, then you have four BB84 states if we're using a BB84 protocol, and you got to be able to switch those, and the switching technology is difficult, not just because what Norbert mentioned about the losses that can take place, but you know, there's a lot of technical issues in going to that switching level. More importantly, we have to have detectors with dead times that are much, much less than a microsecond, and that requires different technologies. Another thing we shouldn't forget about is the synchronization issue. So if you work at kilohertz frequencies, Alice and Bob can each have a clock at their end. So this is a reference frame problem. So they each have their own clock, and then they can time them. Once you get up to gigahertz clocks, they probably need to use the optical fiber that connects them to be able to synchronize. So, you know, if there's a pulse every 100 picoseconds, Alice and Bob have to know which pulses are which, because they lose some along the way. So it's only by having very, very precisely synchronized clocks that they know what's taking place, and they might have to have another channel to be able to maintain the synchronization, especially because, you know, the fiber and all that is going to change over time. Okay, so that's a problem. Another issue that comes up is the need to actively stabilize the quantum channel. So what happens is polarization decoheres in the fiber. So fiber is not polarization preserving, but that's not actually a big problem, because even though it doesn't preserve it, you could characterize it and take advantage of it. You know, if you knew what your fiber did and you fully characterized it, you could possibly undo what it does. The problem is that the birefringence in your fiber is time dependent. And what this does is it causes the polarization decoherence. And that's a big problem. So the way that this is currently avoided is to go to time bands. So what you do, you use polarization encoding that's very fast. So you take your photons, so Alice takes her photons, she sends the photons, and then uses a polarizing beam splitter, and then makes a delay for one polarization relative to the other, brings them back together, and puts them back in the same polarization. So instead of encoding in two polarizations, you encode in early and late. So your qubit is a superposition of early and late. It arrives to Bob. Bob then converts back into polarization and does the measurement. And that method with the early and late can avoid a lot of the problems, because the time-varying properties of the fiber are on a time scale that's longer than the separation of the early and late. So you can assume your early and late experience the same noise. So that's the advantage of it. But a major difficulty is the requirement for the phase locking between Alice and Bob's interferometer if you have phase encoding. So that's, you need the stabilization to be able to do that. A channel has to go through to maintain the phase locking. Okay, and then there's the complicated networks. Unfortunately, I don't have to say much, because Norbert was talking about networks in general, but I will mention that one of the problems we've run into in talking to people in Calgary, in Alberta, about where quantum cryptography could go in the future, because there's actually an effort right now in Alberta to rebuild there's an optical fiber infrastructure that was put in the year 2000, but there's now a committee formed at provincial level to look at a major investment in optical fiber infrastructure for the next 30 years. And they come up to me and they say, okay, well, we're going to put it in. What do you need? You know, it's unusual for somebody to walk up to you and say this. They say, what do you need to have quantum cryptography work in the province, say, you know, on that basis in 30 years? And they say, like, what's your spacing of quantum repeater stations? Or, you know, what do you need to build in? Like, they want to build something, and they want to know now what they should start planning so that, you know, and how do you know 10 years down the road what technology we're going to have, and yet they plan 30 years ahead. So this is an issue. So we're looking at these kinds of problems. But in looking at it, we feel that hybridization becomes extremely important, because even though there's optical fibers to connect everybody together, well, you know, like most parties could be connected, there are points where we find that you want to be able to go to free space channels. So another problem, so the hybridizing becomes very important. This is something that Wolfgang is going to do in his lab, which is to take the photon from the fiber, convert to a free space photon, but not damage it. You know, you have to have the same photon get from Alice to Bob, and if you take the photon out of the fiber and put it in the air, you have to be very careful with it. You can't get rid of it and put another one in its place. The topologies, that's the Seacock work that Norbert mentioned, has a lot of discussion about various topologies. Of course, the topologies in these point-to-point protocols require trust in them, and so trust becomes some assumption you have to worry about. Probably most importantly for us at the moment is the synchronization issue. So when you go to hybridizing, you then have to remember that you need all these synchronization channels, and if you're going to convert your photon from Alice to Bob to free space, you also have to worry about the channels that are used to synchronize, and all these have to also be broadcast. Okay, so I mentioned the point-to-point protocol. That requires trust. Probably we'll use those, but at the same time, Wolfgang has a lab for quantum memory that he'll use towards doing quantum relays. And so the quantum relay, so there's quantum relays and quantum repeaters. Easiest way to think of the difference is the quantum relay allows you to do quantum cryptography over infinite distance, but it's exponentially expensive. And what I mean by exponentially expensive is the bit generation rate drops off exponentially with the distance. So your bit rate goes down exponentially. It should be a minus sign. Sorry about that. And so you have an exponential cost. And to do that, just to get this exponential cost, already requires difficult technologies like teleportation or entanglement swapping, maybe quantum error correction if your detector's too noisy. We don't yet have to worry about decoherence in fiber, so this is kind of a blessing because we can ignore that in the first instance. And using the quantum relay, we can extend distance. And probably a quantum relay makes sense to develop before really thinking about quantum repeater technology. And then the advantage of the quantum repeater is that it's polynomial cost and distance. So then it becomes at least theoretically feasible if that technology can be done, but that's so much more difficult that it's not something we're seriously considering at the moment. The major obstacle that we've identified in being able to go this direction is really the requirement for quantum memory. So I've emphasized again and again the importance of synchronization. If we're going to synchronize, then we have to have a way of storing photons and then releasing them on demand. And to be able to have that memory, we're trying a number of avenues. Actually, another experimentalist in Calgary, Alex Lebovsky, has a lab. He's doing this quantum memory stuff in rubidium gas. And then Wolfgang, I'll tell you more in a moment, Wolfgang's going to be doing it in probably rare earth, embedded in fiber, or possibly rare earth ions in crystals with embedded waveguides. So there's a couple of options, each one with its problems. But it's nice because with the atomic system, we know a lot more of the physics. So in Alex's lab, the quantum memory and the relay capability can be tested in a system that we understand the physics and then we can see what happens. Wolfgang's would probably be the practical one, and then in Wolfgang's we understand the physics a bit less, but we can extrapolate from what we learn in one lab to another. So it's a very nice collaboration. It will be, well, Wolfgang doesn't have a lab yet, so it will have been a nice collaboration. Okay. So in order to do the relay, the plan would be to use entanglement swapping and linear optics. We don't want to bring... The nonlinear optics comes in with the quantum memory, but the otherwise you just use linear optics to do the measurement. We know this. Norbert did some nice work a number of years ago proving that with linear optics you can't do Bell state measurements with better than 50% with better than 50% success. And if you look at a lot of the experiments, in fact, it's 25%. 25% is easier to do, but you can't do better than a 50% success rate with entanglement swapping. But that's okay, because you know when it works, so you can use it. But in order to do this, the synchronization is important. You do entanglement swapping, which means that you have different points in your line between Alice and Bob that are generating photon pairs. And the photon pairs have to arrive on time. Now, there's actually more than one problem here, because currently our photon pair generations are spontaneous, which means they occur at random times. So you have different points along your line, each one generating a pair. It's bad news if they generate them at different times. Maybe quantum memory can store and trigger. But even if you make them at the same time, you have to have your pair generation that's going to be make them arrive simultaneously. So the Bell state measurement requires the two photons coming from different points to overlap, and the overlap has to be better than better than the coherence time. There's a coherence length of 1 micron. So if you look at the coherence, you think it's really good. But the problem is that a fiber undergoes heating. So looking at the specifications on a fiber usually doesn't tell you enough. What's important to remember is that for every kilometer of fiber, for every change in 1 degree Celsius, it can extend by 8 millimeters. So a micron coherence length is actually pretty irrelevant. It's the heating. And you can't get around these temperature variations that take place. So you really, again, you have to have extra channels to be able to do the synchronization to know when the photons are generated. And the way you do it is active stabilization that requires added channels. Or you could do spectral filtering, but if you do spectral filtering, your rate drops dramatically. So spectral filtering might be the way to go initially, and then later on you have to do the active stabilization. Okay, so I've mentioned the drawbacks of InGaAs. Probably the next development that will be important for improving the performance of quantum key distribution in terms of how many bits per second you can get, the bit generation rate, we'll probably be using these transition edge sensors. I won't go into the physics of it, but the transition edge sensors, I'll just tell you, I think of these like thermometers. You know, if you want to know how many photons arrive, just shine a light into a glass of water, photons heat up the glass of water, you pop a thermometer in, and then you measure the temperature change. So in a way, it's a very oversimplified way, but it helps to think about it. One of the problems with that, of course, is if you fire photons into a glass of water, they could be any wavelength and heat it up. So in order to use the thermometer to measure photons, you'd have to do a spectral filter in front to make sure only photons of a particular color got in. So once you do that with the spectral filtering, the transition edge sensors would have a quantum efficiency of 0.9. That's much better than the 0.1 that we saw earlier. And the dark count rate is really low with sufficient spectral filtering. So instead of 10 to the minus 5 is it much better? No. How many seconds in a day? 86,400. So, okay. It's not much better. But you get one dark count per day. So these are advantages. This is why the transition edge sensors look so good. They're still being developed, but this would be something to plug in. But the problem is going to be that even though those are good, just like the InGaAs system, the clock speed has to be very slow. So even with the transition edge sensors, you can improve performance, but you won't pick up your bit rate. So that may not be good. There are other detector technologies that are being talked about, but there's still speculation. So to be able to get detectors to go faster will take some more time. How much time have I got? 7 minutes, okay. So and then some of the issues with synchronization I mentioned before would be that we need pairs on demand. You know, you want to know when your photons are going to be made, but they're not. Currently, when we make photon pairs, typically we do spontaneous parametric down conversion through some sort of nonlinear optical crystal, which means that if you have this relay system, your photon pairs are being generated at random times, and that puts a lot of demands on your quantum memory issues, so that's going to be a problem. Our detectors are probabilistic. So currently at 10% telecom wavelength, with transition edge sensors, we could get up to 90%. The transmission is probabilistic. And so all these losses, the inefficient detectors, the random generation of photons, all these go in to challenge the security of a quantum key distribution system over longer distance. At least if we could get pairs on demand, then we could possibly improve the quantum efficiency. And here, maybe other people in Canada are doing this, but I know Gregor Weiss Waterloo is working on these quantum dot sources, and so it would be very useful to have quantum dots that generate photons on demand. The only experiment I know that's demonstrated entanglement for photon pair generation of quantum dot was done by Andrew Shields' group. Does anybody know any others? No? Okay, so I think it's finally been demonstrated experimentally, so at least we're on track to having pairs on demand. Okay, and then the quantum memory, how we proceed on that. Initially, we use a photon echo, and I won't have time to go into the physics of this, but what would happen is you take cooled ions, probably rare earth ions like erbium, or you could do titanium-diffused waveguides and use something there, but we could just think of rare earth ions that would be sitting within crystals or fibers. Fibers, a waveguide, you can make a crystal into a waveguide by some diffusion process, and then the ions would be cooled cryogenically. You bring them down to very low temperatures, and then what happens is these rare earth ions behave very beautifully like two-level systems, although the plan that Wolfgang has is to use three-level systems for reasons I won't go into. They behave very beautifully. They're two-level systems. They have a narrow homogeneous line width, so that just means that the T1 is small. So with your qubit, the probability, so in like an error correction language, probability of getting a knot is very small. So you have a narrow homogeneous line width, but you have significant inhomogeneous broadening, because what happens is every qubit, so your 0 and 1 states are separated by energy, each one has, you know, each one in itself its energy separation has very little width to it. It's very fine, but they're all located in different points, and each one feels different crystal defects and strain effects, and they broaden it out. So overall, you have this giant broadening effect. However, in quantum optics, for many years, the technique of photon echo has been developed precisely to get around these problems, to do spectroscopy on systems, learning about these levels. And the idea is that if you store your quantum information in the qubits, then what you do is you rotate. So like if you had them all in the zero state, you rotate like a Hadamard in each one. Then you have the inhomogeneous broadening effects. Then what you do is hit it with a pi pulse. Then to first order, all your diffusion is reversed, and then you flip back. So you can cancel it out. And I think it's like bang bang in the bang bang technology, bang bang idea in quantum control. So that's the idea. So the idea there is to be able to do it. The plan is actually to go to three level systems, because we want to use an electric field to be able to have controllability over inhomogeneous broadening. So the idea is that when you have the broadening, you get high absorption. When you don't have it, and you want to be able to turn on and off your absorption to be able to get quantum memory. So, you know, when you're sending the photons in, you've got to release them at the right time. So you need an added mechanism for control. The third level comes in. It gives you the ability to absorb and then shut off the absorption. There's some stuff on it. But that's what we want to do, is to apply the photon echo to memory. And then there's bandwidth issues. You want to be able to match. So I talked about spectral filtering. You want to be able to do that so that you match the photon bandwidth to the bandwidth of the medium. So when you make your quantum memory, you have to remember what the spectral range of your photon is and make sure it fits into the medium. And you don't want to lose photons, because that challenges security. And then, as I said before, you store the photon and switch on and off by an electric field. So when you get the photon, you switch off the electric field, then you store and do photon echo techniques. When you're ready to take the photon back out, then you turn back on the electric field. But then the problem is going to be you have to store for a long time. You might have multiple events to store, and ultimately you might have to do some sort of multiplexing. So it's not enough to put one photon in the medium. You have to find a way to store different photons in the same medium and extract the one that you want to extract. So that puts more challenges on. Yeah, that's what it's telling you here. Right, okay, no, this is different. This is the multiple photons, and I don't have time to go into it, so I won't. But the message here is really, this is going back to the multi-photon component that you have. And then we've been looking at, and I'm sure other people know more than I do on this, I've only started thinking about it, how to connect the decoy state idea with the quantum memory idea. And then just when you do simple calculations, like when I do them, I find problems like you have a Bell state measurement going on, and when you have multiple photons, you get false Bell state measurements, and that's going to challenge. If you use a linear optical technique, it challenges how to do it. So I would love to see how to put the decoy states into a quantum relay setting. There's some experts here in the audience, so I'm hoping today I get a chance to talk to people. But these are just questions coming up. And then, of course, finally, and the one that we actually talk a lot about, but I'm not going to talk about here, are the commercial issues. So in raising industrial funding to support the project, the things they care about is how are you going to, how are you going to plug it into our system? Like, they don't want, in the end, they just want a black box, right? Here's the black box. This is how it performs. They can test it under various conditions. And they just want to know, how are you going to build it into existing crypto systems? How does the user not see it? Never use the word quantum. So you turn people off when you say quantum. It's just cryptography. It might be information theoretically secure cryptography or enhanced security or something. But if you measure the word mention the word quantum, you lose potential investors, I find. What was it that Stephen Hawking was told? Every equation you put in, you lose 50% of the number of buyers. So you put one equation in and cut his... I think V equals MC squared, cut the buyers in half. Same thing here. Every time you say quantum, people just glaze over. So you need integration and packaging, ease of operation. How does the user use it? You want somebody with a two-year tech degree, tech diploma, being able to run the equipment and fixing it. So these are problems. We work with the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology, so they have tech students who are doing two-year or three-year programs in electronics and in optical networks. And so we're going to be working with them to make sure that the stuff will happen. Aging is actually a problem. So in all the stuff I mentioned to you, and you set up your quantum memory and the rest, you've got to know the lifetime. You can't go dig up holes in the ground every 6 months and replace devices. Things have to live for years, and we have no clue what the lifetimes of things are yet. And the other thing is that there will be a test bed for these. The test beds will probably be at General Dynamics Canada. They're setting up a lab for it, and then they will test the equipment and find out if it works under these conditions. So I'll summarize with the main points, and the main points are, chair's getting nervous. It's okay, I always finish on time, I think. So the goal is the main goal here, it's nice to have a goal, even if you can't get there. The goal is megahertz key generation rate from current kilohertz rates. That's what we want to get to. But as I pointed out, until we figure out these detector problems, it's hard to boost it. So we can boost with better efficiency, et cetera, some things, but we want three orders of magnitude. That's the goal. We believe that the next breakthroughs require new detectors. The transition edge sensor is the way to go initially, but it seems to have problems that won't work. There are other kinds of detectors that are being talked about, but not clear yet what will work, how they work, et cetera. So there's more physics needed to be done to think of new detectors. If you think of timescales and you consider these sorts of issues, you have to remember that your pulses have to be 50 picoseconds long, with a pulse separation of 100 picoseconds. So back to your question, putting in Morgan gas detectors, that won't even work here because you've got 2 nanoseconds. Well, maybe you could do it shorter, but these timescales are extremely short. You're down to sub-nanosecond timescales. And we also want on-demand. It's very hard to work with spontaneous generation of pulses. The more probabilistic your system, the more hard it is to control. And finally, synchronization is immensely important. For the easier systems, you have to synchronize by having other channels to be able to send classical information back and forth just to make sure you synchronize your quantum information. But ultimately, we need this quantum memory because to do the synchronization, we have to be able to hold. Even if you get on-demand, I told you about that 1 degree, 8 millimeters of extension of a fiber for an increase of 1 degree. These are enormous to us. So even when you get things synchronized, you still have to have memory to be able to time and trigger. So in the concept that we have about triggering, you have an electric field that turns on and off your memory, but that electric field needs to be triggered by some synchronization channel, and then you release it. So that this is all very important, and it has to be very fast. And then just put some numbers. Yeah, so what happens if you look at the time scale, the photon transit time, if we want to do 100 kilometer distances, that's without relay. That's about 500 microseconds. So our memory times that we need should be on the order of 10 milliseconds to be able to cope with 100 kilometer distance. And remembering, it's just not one trip over the fiber, it's multiple trips back and forth. So when you're timing things and you have multiple trips, you want to be able to develop quantum memory with 10 millisecond timescales. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Calgary, company would actually use the service. That may be as their main content of service, not as their main object of photography, but still, just use it.
Okay, so the question is, when is it realistic to expect a company in Calgary to build quantum cryptography or use it? So the argument that I put forward is we're still in a pre-competitive stage. So we do have companies that are selling quantum cryptography systems. So in a sense, there is that commercial effort out there. The goal in Calgary is not to set up a company to do what? Yeah, okay. No, I think it's realistic to get some proof of principle, you know, like what they did in Vienna, for example. I don't think it'd be hard for us to go to a bank and say, send us some money and use quantum cryptography, because, of course, we won't get the money if there's any flaw in the security, so it's no risk to them. But the goal at the moment is to look at the broad scope and put it all together. So the plan would not be, ultimately, would be, you know, somebody else creates it. General Dynamics Canada's goal would be, when they feel it's ready, they would buy stuff and put it together. Their market, though, is the so-called Type 1 crypto market, which is the extremely sensitive defense issues. And so, from their perspective, they don't see the banks as somebody that they would look at as a customer for any time in the foreseeable future. What they would do would be to take it over into a defense setting and then to bundle it. And the advantage of working in the defense industry would be that the price is not the main object. It's the security that's very important. What's realistic? I mean, part of it is the theory, like what Norbert was talking about, that you have to be confident about the security, and that to me is a little bit unpredictable. You know, a lot more theory needs to be done to know what the security issues are. But on the experimental side, they really want to see these 10 megabit a second scales. So I think we're still years away. So at the moment, they're giving money. I think even to get these transition edge sensors to start playing a good role to boost that efficiency is 2 or 3 years down the road. And then we have other detectors that aren't developed yet. So I can't see getting up to those rates in better than 5 years. I don't mean to sound pessimistic, because I'm actually quite optimistic on the 10-year timescale. But I don't think, like, the way that we're working is we're saying, what can we do in 10 years? So over 5 years, we want to get something that will meet certain specs, create a lab that will test it under realistic conditions, where they change temperatures and all that. We also have the fiber running underground in real fiber systems. We have to hybridize, because actually the defense industry is more interested in through the air. I don't know, if you think about what people do. Through the air, at the moment. They're interested in through the air, but we're not. I mean, we're interested. So we're doing it in the fibers at the moment, and other groups in Canada are doing through the air. But probably, yeah, I mean, I won't go into what they need, you know, that but they have their own particular needs. But at the moment, what we're doing serves their needs as well. Oh, with the, no, I mean, if you did a relay, so you just do an entanglement swapping, then you can, Alice and Bob can sift the data to be able to ascertain. You can use the standard BB84, I mean, people know more than I do, but my understanding, you just use the standard BB84 processes to compare the two. But if you do point-to-point protocols, where you have intermediaries and classical information in between, then you have to make trust assumptions. But in the quantum relay or quantum repeater setting, it's always quantum information. So another way of putting it is, Alice and Bob don't care how the photon got there. And if Eve does anything, then they can check for her intrusion. And, you know, you could think of the quantum relay as a sophisticated teleportation. You know, in a way, it's not the same photon that Alice gets to Bob, but if she teleported the photon to Bob, it would be just as good. Yes. That's true. But then, yeah, that's right. How long before something? I mean, okay, so there. So let me give you a trade secret. When you do physics and you want to write papers in top journals like Nature or something, things always work. You know, you can't report something otherwise. So I'm very optimistic that there will be a set of papers in Nature and Science that report that these things work. So in that sense, I'm optimistic. In terms of getting something that will serve the purpose of reaching higher bit rates, meeting the stringent security requirements, etc., then I think we're still a long way away with the memory, because we don't. There's more physics that needs to be done in knowing just how to get the quantum information in and back out. Like, until we study the system, we don't really know if we meet the synchronization requirements. And you know what I'm saying? Like,
even if you sacrifice the
Yeah, I am. Yeah, let's say 1 bit a second is our goal. Okay. Okay.
Or even 200.
Oh. Yeah, I think, well, 200 or 300 is probably going to be feasible with better detectors. So one of the advantages of the transition edge sensors is that it will extend the distance. There's no relay, though. So I... No, but I'm not cheating. I'm... No, yeah, okay, I am cheating. Okay, so, yeah, all right. So I can cheat a little bit by saying we'll go beyond 100 kilometers with better detectors. But then not to cheat is to say, okay, but how far can you not get, and then use a relay. And then, to me, it gets into the fundamental physics issues that nobody has explored. Like, if we use photon echo, like, there's different possibilities for how to do the quantum memory. And then somebody comes up with an idea and says, how about we use photon echo, or how about we use this or that? And then you go back and you look at the equations and what's been done, and they're always done in spectroscopic settings. So the way that a lot of this has been done is saying, well, what can we learn about the atoms or ions or whatever we're going to use, and not how much can we control them? So then we get into quantum control problems, and then I really can't answer, because I just think we have to do basic physics to understand that. And then whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic doesn't matter, because I'm at a point of maximum ignorance.